3, verse 6, the concluding part of the introduction to this book of Judges. I've entitled the series, if you remember, Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Kingdom Come. This is a book, yes, three times the cockerel is crowing there in the distance. That was more than three. Three for each one of us, maybe. Lord, keep us from Peter's denials. Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Kingdom Come. I've given the title to this series, Thy Kingdom Come, as we look at the book of Judges, because I sense that in the reading of the book, this great desire that this phase in Israel's history would be closed and a new phase of history under the auspices of a godly and anointed king would begin. There's a great desire to see the kingdom come, and I hope you also pray your kingdom come, that you still want to see the kingdom coming in all the manifest ways that prayer might be answered. In this passage here, though, we see a phase of history where the kingdom is not yet incensed. God is king, but there's still a time when they haven't appointed and ordained a king amongst them to rule as his regent amongst them. And so there's that sense of burden for the day when he would appear. There are three things I want to pick out from this. You're enjoying that, aren't you? Yeah, definitely. We're in the country now, Hayley. Just need a braying donkey and we'd be there, wouldn't we? A few chickens. Three things I want to particularly pull out. First is the anger of the Lord. I think this passage writes it large, doesn't it? The anger of the Lord being kindled. The second thing, wonderfully, is the pity of the Lord. Even in his anger, he's still merciful. And that's a wonderful thing to know, isn't it? And finally, thirdly, the wisdom of the Lord. That God is angered, but he still shows pity, and in all things, his wisdom continues to guide all his acts in his dealings with his people. The anger, the pity, and the wisdom of God. So that's our title for tonight. The anger, the pity, and the wisdom of God. So this book of Judges, records a 400-year period. I don't think that period is kind of in providence very similar to that period that they spent down in Egypt as slaves, and here we almost see a parallel, having been saved by the auspices of Moses at the end of that 400 year from their slavery. Here they are for 400 years living in this second class condition until such time as a king should be appointed, and of course that king is David, the great deliverer of his people. There's a parallel here between this and that former experience, and it is a time of spiritual immaturity. And we don't have a record of what took place during the 400 years when they were in Egypt, but we can't imagine that there was any great particular spiritual flourishing or awakening, because we have no record thereof. But you'd imagine we might have, and likewise in this period there is very little spiritually to commend what takes place over what is a very, very long period of time. And sometimes the truth is that we spiritually idle for quite considerable time until we get revived, and that's eventually what happens. In the course of this book, there are seven apostasies, seven times the people of God. By apostasy, I mean not just slight backsliding or sin, but a full-scale, wholehearted rejection of God and a turning to other gods. Seven times the whole nation, in effect, turns away from the Lord, ceases to worship him, and starts worshiping the local Baals, the little deities, the gods of the trees and the brooks and fertility and the harvest and all these petty things which God, our God, is the sovereign ruler over all. They are in the swill bucket, aren't they? They are satisfying themselves like the prodigal son on the pods that the pigs eat, rather than they could be at home with dad eating a feast. Seven times through the course of this period that happens, and seven times what follows these apostasies, it's as predictable as anything, follows a period of oppression. So as they begin to worship the gods of the local people, you think, well, this is a pathway to peace. We're going to get on with our neighbors. We're worshiping the same gods now. But instead, those nations become stronger and begin to oppress Israel and put them to slavery again. They keep returning to slavery again, going back as they were in Egypt. Seven times, seven apostasies, seven oppressions. And yet God in his mercy produces 12, not all at the same time, 12 judges who are raised up one after the other, who bring relief to this oppression and apostasy. Every time the judge appears, God is with the judge, as we heard, and the enemies are pushed back in a period of peace. They get to remember what it's like to live under God's rule again, and we see this pattern happening again and again. Well, this whole book highlights and this need. We don't just need people to be raised up from time to time to help us. We need the constant rule of a godly authority, not just a judge who spontaneously pops up and does great things while everybody else carries on basically living just as they were while they do all the work. Don't want to do that. We want a king who brings loyalty from his people and they serve God together. That's the great desire and the passion of the book, that the kingdom would come, that a godly king would appear, and that people would give their hearts to him. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, which is so evidently absent in what we've just been reading about. God knows we need a king, that he's set a king over us, hasn't he? He's set a king in the person of the Lord Jesus. He knows we need someone like him to rule us, to command us, to govern us, to lead us, to go out before us. And he has provided that for us wonderfully in the person of Jesus. So at the beginning of the book, in chapter 1 and verse 2, the Lord said, Judah shall go up. Behold, Judah shall go up. Well, they're seeking, how should we go forward? What's the way ahead? And God indicates that Judah shall go up. And it's no accident. Judah is the royal tribe. From Judah will come. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. The expectation that Judah will produce for the nation this king. And of course, in the fullness of time, Judah does, in the person of David, and consequently later in the person of Jesus. This is the kingly tribe. But seemingly, though Judah is pointed out, they fail to understand that there's a destiny, they should produce a king, and they carry on, and yet no king is appointed. And what we are forced to watch, this great beginning to the passage, and they go out and they bash up the Canaanites and they bash up the Perizzites. Just if you're interested to know what a Perizzite is, a Perizzite is a villager or a liver in hamlet. So basically the Perizzites were kind of living in the rural areas, you know, the little villages, you know, the sort of thing, whereas the Canaanites were living in cities and towns. It's not immediately evident, is it, from the passage, but that's what they are. But they had success in the country and success in the cities. They did well. But as we read through the passage, gradually the juggernaut of Judah begins to run down. And we see, let's say, verse 19, and the Lord was with Judah. He took possession of the hill country. And then we get the first but. There's always a but, isn't there? With all the people that God raises up, it seems there's always a but, except in the person of Jesus. But he, this is Judah, could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain, it says in verse 19, chapter 1, because they had chariots of iron. Because they had chariots of iron, that's what we read. So Judah starts well, but by the end, by chapter 19, already they're saying they've come to their end. They've come to their limits, and there's still a whole lot of work to be done. Chariots of iron. When you think about the sort of things that God has done in the past, do you think chariots of iron are a match for Almighty God? I mean, this is the God who opened the Red Sea. This is the God who made Israel cross in the floods of Jordan. This is the God who brought down the walls of Jericho. Do iron chariots really present an insurmountable problem to our God? What is this that we read? Is it really true that they could not drive these people out because they had iron chariots? If that is an excuse I've ever heard, you know, the dog ate my homework. This is the dog ate my homework, isn't it? Right? This was too hard for me. I can't do that. I can't go that far. But that's what we read. They did not drive out the Canaanites because of these chariots of iron. I remember in Mark chapter 6 and verses 5 and 6, there's that kind of interesting account, isn't there, in Mark's gospel of what took place. And Jesus went preaching everywhere, and he did these remarkable works, didn't he? And in chapter 6, we read that, verse 5 and 6, this is concerning Nazareth, and he could do no mighty work there except that he laid hands on a few sick people and healed them, and he marveled because of their Unbelief. Unbelief. It's not that he couldn't do miracles there. Surely he's not limited by their unbelief. But their unbelief somehow inhibited him proceeding forward and doing the things that he could do. Now, and we've read in this passage in Judges how God was able to drive the Canaanites out, but he says, I will not do it because of their unbelief. At a certain point, I suppose what I'm saying is this chariots of iron became bigger in their minds than God. And that was a symptom of their unbelief. They stopped believing that God could do it. All the time before, they'd seen God doing it, and they'd put that into practice. They'd exerted faith, and God had met them in their moment. And now, for some reason, these chariots of iron, they're looking at these things, like tanks, I suppose, in the ancient world, the equivalent of a tank. They're looking down the barrel of a tank gun, and they're suddenly thinking, that becomes their God. It's bigger than God. It's eclipsing God in their minds. So there they are, no mighty works. The works of God seem to stop. The progress seems to stop. And what you begin to see as you go down this passage, we looked at it before, is that this, because they're the leading tribe. You only have to look at chapter 1, verse 21, just a couple of verses down, and here are some of the other tribes, like Benjamin. Well, no, Judah won't do it. Benjamin won't drive them out either. And as you go down the list, you see tribe after tribe, like Joseph is one of the biggest tribes. They've got two whole tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim. And there in verses 27 and 29, Manasseh didn't drive them out. At verse 29, Ephraim didn't drive them out. You see, once it starts, once the slide starts, once the unbelief sets in, it's infectious, especially as if it's in the leadership. And that's, Judah is the leader. They're the leaders, the leading voices. And they're saying the chariots of iron are too much. And unsurprisingly, the others start to pick up the cue. And the whole thing starts to grind to a halt. All these people are left in their places one after another. Until we get to chapter 1, verse 34, and we hit the bottom. Dan is the last one to be mentioned. Dan, the Amorites, press the people of Dan back. They're not just slowing down and stopping. Now they're being pushed backwards. They're retreating. The people of God have gone into reverse because they won't go forward. It's forwards or backwards. And that's what we see here in the passage. This terrible slide into apostasy. Chapter 2 and verse 10, which is where we were started our reading just a little bit before. There's this kind of this new generation that doesn't know the Lord or the work that he's done for Israel. Until such a point, they've gone into reverse and they're not seeing God at work at all anymore. They don't know God. They've never seen God at work. They've never seen God deliver a victory. We read that first line of our reading tonight. The people of Israel do what was evil in the sight of the Lord, serve the Baals. Maybe they start to think, well, maybe God won't do anything. Maybe we'll have to go and find someone else who can deliver for us and give us victory or will help us and find a way forward. They go to the Baals for help. And then in verse 12, they completely abandon the Lord, the God of their fathers. And there's this bitter reminder. He brought them up out of the land of Egypt. He delivered them already. And yet they go after these other gods. All these countries and nations, they defeated one after the other. And why? What they're doing to go after them, we just cannot begin to imagine. But the consequence is, this is important, at the end there of verse 12, it begins to affect their, God starts to become angry. Now, all the kind of classic theological confessions of faith will tell us that God has no body or parts or passions. And by that, basically, if I want to draw that down into some of the most crude sort of paraphrasing I can think of, God's not moody. He doesn't just have moods. He doesn't feel angry one day and feel grumpy another and happy the other day. That's not what God, he's totally consistent. This anger is not him being moody. This anger is perfectly representative and responsive to the actual circumstances which are presenting. It's absolutely appropriate anger given the circumstances. I suppose as we've been thinking about it, you can understand that, can't you? Why God would be angry with his people for this, would you, any of you, turn your back on a monarch. If you were invited into the presence of a monarch, it's a profound insult, isn't it, to turn your back. You're supposed to bow, you leave like this, and you keep your face, you always keep your face. They've turned their back on the Lord. And they're showing him their backsides, right? And they're bowing down and showing their backsides in all their glory as they bow down to other and lesser gods. This is profoundly, profoundly insulting. Understandably, we can see that God is angered. Why? God hates sin. He hates it with an absolutely perfect hatred. There is nothing about sin that he will kind of draw any kind of peace with. He hates it with a pure and perfect hatred, and the appearance of sin draws his righteous anger and indignation. And that's what we see here in this passage. God is angry. And if you're like me, that's a fairly... We heard the thunder this morning. And the point is made again in verse 14, isn't it? We've been told once he's been provoked. They're provoking the Lord to anger. There's a sense of quiet and gradual development. We're told in the book of Proverbs that we should be slow to anger. Why? Because God is slow to anger, isn't he? He's not rash or impetuous. This is the gradual build-up of an accumulation towards a perfect expression of a righteous anger. He's not slow to anger. They are provoking him. And there in verse 14, the anger of the Lord was kindled. It's on fire now. Anybody here been angry? The red mist, the fire. Here it is. Here it is. It's kindled against, and it's directed on Israel. He's angry with Israel. But it's very, very informative, this, that when we look down and continue in verse 14, you see, I don't know what you do with your anger. What do you do with your anger? Do you find it problematic? Do you find anger problematic? You know, where do I put this? What do I do with this? How do I process this? Is there a sort of little lead box I can put it in and shut the lid and boom, controlled explosion? What do you do with your anger? Here we watch what God does with his anger. And there in verse 14, we see what he does with his anger. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. So that's what he did with his anger. He made a decision. He handed them over to their enemies, and their enemies plundered them. He sold them into the hands of their surrounding enemies so that he could no longer withstand their enemies. He stood back from them, hasn't he? He's taken his hands off them. He's exposed them to the world as it is and withdrawn his protection from it. And we see in verse 15, they marched out. They continue to sort of act as if God was still with them. He marched out, but the hand of the Lord was against them for harm. As the Lord, and this is really, really important, verse 15. Verse 15 is very important. As the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them. Do you see the importance of that? The importance of this is to note this. He has declared clearly to them what the consequences of sin will be, not in anger, in evenness and openness, and they have signed up to this covenant. He's told them exactly what will happen if they do so and so and so and so. And when it happens, he does exactly that. He doesn't deviate from it. This isn't an emotional outburst. It's not erratic. He's not clutching at straws or breaking plates. He's doing exactly what he told them that they would do, he would do, and he does it. He sees it through. Complete consistency and conformity to his own will. Declared will, which they have accepted and understand. So there it is, using his anger very, very precisely. They had refused to go forward. They'd refused to take the enemies on, refused to fight against these chariots, it seems. And this is the consequence. This is the judgment. If you won't fight the chariots of iron, you'll have to fight me. There's the choice. Me or the chariots of iron. We're called to fight the good fight, aren't we? Aren't we? We're called as Christians to fight the good fight, the fight of faith. And if we won't fight the good fight, we end up fighting God. Because he will have his way, won't he? He is determined to have his way, and he's made it clear, and he's made it plain to us. And what happens if we don't fight the good fight? What will happen? Our enemies, those who oppose the gospel, who oppose the truth. If we just stand back and let it all happen, what is going to happen? Are they going to say, well, they're nice people, those Christians. They don't bother us. We'll leave them alone. They won't. This is exactly what we see here in this passage. The nations all around are emboldened and strengthened and begin to push and to develop their own domains and gradually erode and break down the centers of control and power of God's people until eventually they are on the back foot and in retreat. There is no neutral ground. There is no sitting on the fence. It's forwards or backwards. There's no standing still. There's no standing still. Their enemies end up prevailing. God is so measured with them. He's patient with them. He tells them in advance what he will do. It's predetermined, and he's just working out exactly what he said. And that's perfectly reasonable, isn't it? It's perfectly reasonable. Should God, if they will not fight their enemies, if they won't fight the battles God has given them to fight, should God fight them for them? Should he go out on his own and take on those chariots of iron and deliver the broken wreckage of those instruments of war at their doors and say, I've done it for you? Do you think that would be right and appropriate for them to do? If they will go, he will go with them. He will fight with them and for them. But if they won't go at all, he's not going to fight their battles in that sense for them. We are to be cooperators with grace. Cooperators with grace. We come to verse 16. So that's the anger of the Lord. The anger of the Lord. Reasonable, measured response to people's sin. But then in verse 16, we read something wonderful and remarkable. Because though God is angry, he raises up judges. He raises up judges. He raises up saviors for the people. We read in verse 18 that he didn't do it once. He did it time and time and time again. 12 times he raised up these judges. And in your general reading of the passage in verse 18, is it because every time he raised up a judge, they repented and turned back to the Lord? Is that why he raised up these judges? Because he knew they'd respond positively to this ministry that he was going to? As you read through it, their hearts are not changed at all. They're continuing in their unrepentance. They continue in their sin and rebellion. And the Lord works through this judge alone, and salvation comes through that person alone. But what is motivating God? Why would he do this? Why would he do it? Verse 18, we're told categorically what the reason was. He saved them from the hand of the days, from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge, for the Lord was moved to pity. Do you love the Lord? Do you love him? In his anger, still kind, still merciful, still caring for his people. They're groaning. They hate. They're not enjoying this discipline, are they? They're not enjoying the discipline they're experiencing. And he doesn't harden his heart to them because of their ill practices and unrepentant ways. He doesn't stop loving them for a moment. He loves them and he cares about them and he remains pitiful towards them. And he raises up these judges to alleviate something of the worst excesses of the consequences of their own sins, the consequences of their own actions. We have a gracious God. Even when he's angry, he still loves his people. His love never changes. It's hard to realize that sometimes, isn't it? Because when somebody's angry with you, isn't it often the case that you read that anger as being hatred or that somebody doesn't like you, they're angry with you. And so we find it hard to believe that standing behind that anger is love. But with God, even in his anger, his love remains absolutely constant and fixed upon his people. God is not like us. Because truthfully, often when we're angry, actually what is coming out is bitterness and resentment, isn't it? It's not gracious. It's not seasoned with pity and care. It's selfish and so on. But God is not like us. So even when judgment is coming on his people, the love of God is constant. Constant. Just on a practical note then. So if you're experiencing the grace and the mercy and the pity of God, does that mean he's not angry with you? Not necessarily. There still may be things in our lives that there may be things that he really hates that are continuing in our lives. And the fact that he still shows us, we shouldn't misread that kindness to think that, oh, he doesn't mind, he doesn't care. He cares deeply. He cares for you, and he cares that this change comes. Both things together. And obviously, sometimes he's not angry with us. We shouldn't assume that every time we find mercy and pity from him, that it's standing behind that is his anger. But his love is constant. Even in anger, we need to remember his love. So here we see in verse 20, just coming down to this, so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel because the people have transgressed my covenant that I commanded their fathers and have not obeyed my voice. In his anger, he's still merciful. So that's my second point to you. When God is angry, he still shows pity because we have a wonderful God. We have a gracious God. So lastly then, because God's anger never eclipses his wisdom, do you know what I mean by that? I mean, how many times in your anger have you said something that you've regretted or done something foolish or said something foolish? God never says or does something he regrets or is foolish in his anger. His anger never overwhelms him. He's always in control of his anger. And so his wisdom is guiding even his anger and the use of his pity towards his people. So, chapter 3, verse 1, we're told that all these nations that have been left behind, so even in this situation, this very ugly situation where the people won't go forwards, and he is now fighting against them rather than for them, nevertheless, he has a purpose even for this whole situation. He's not kind of taken by surprise by this whole situation. He's got a plan. These are the nations that the Lord left, and then we get a comma, and then a phrase, and then another comma, and in that gap we see, to test Israel by them. There's a purpose. He's going to use this situation even for a purpose. What was the problem? From the beginning, they wouldn't fight. They refused to fight. They stopped fighting the good fight of faith. And consequently, he refused to fight for them, instead rather to fight against them. But even in that, he's planning to help them through this situation. See, the truth is, if you won't fight against chariots, you'll end up fighting against God. But either way, what does he get you doing? He gets you fighting, doesn't he? You're either going to fight chariots and win with God's help, or you're going to fight God and lose because God is against you, one or the other. But either way, he keeps you fit, all right? He keeps you moving. He keeps you active. He doesn't let you rest and stop. He keeps you fighting. And what the big problem these people had was, they weren't fighting. They weren't used to fighting. And God's people are supposed to be a martial people, the church militant. We're not there yet. We've got to stay in the fight. And so whether we're fighting and losing against God, and that hurts, and at a certain point, do you get sick of losing? You get fed up of losing? Eventually, somebody, a judge, somebody raises up, I've had enough of losing. I'm turning to the living God, and God wonderfully works through them. But either way, he gets his people fighting, doesn't he? And then when the judge is serving the Lord and continuing going forwards, what happens is they get an experience of victory and they're reminded, oh, this is what victory tastes like. Who here has fasted? Everybody here had the experience of fasting or an extended fast. What does food taste like at the other end? Well, I've just been away for 10 days. And absence makes the heart grow fonder, doesn't it? You come back and simple things that you'd perhaps just take for granted, suddenly, oh, this is so good. This is so good. And exactly like this, they lose contact with what the experience of winning is. They don't know what winning is anymore. So when the judge is raised up, suddenly they get the taste of victory. Now, this is sweet. This is good. And he's keeping them active, isn't he? Losing, winning. But either way, it doesn't matter. He's keeping them fit because he's keeping them fighting. We're supposed to be a martial people, not a people at ease, a warring people. So he's keeping them in shape. Why do they need to be in shape? Because the whole burden of this book, where is this whole book going? What's the end of the book of Judges to be? They're supposed to be coming to the end where they're sick and tired of doing this, going round in circles, boom and bust. They're supposed to come to a point where they see their need of a king. And when that king comes, he has to have an army to lead. And when he comes, and in this case we're talking about David perhaps, who is it that he has to fight? Who is it the enemies? We read in chapter 3, verse 3, the five lords of the Philistines. Who were the first battles that David went out against? Who did they go out against? The Philistines. And he had an army ready to fight. You know, whether you lose, whether you win, you stay fit, don't you? So when the king comes, and the king is going to lead you to victory, you are ready for the battle, and they're being prepared for those things. So I think the last thing I've got to say, really, is that we see here in this passage the anger of the Lord, the righteous anger of God. We should remember that even in his anger, he's pitiful and merciful towards his people. And finally think that he is a wise God. And all the time he's preparing us for the coming of the kingdom. Do you want to be ready when the king comes? So through thick or thin, through victories and defeats, in right decisions and wrong decisions, in the end, God will prepare us and ready us for the day of his appearing. And that's what he's doing in our lives all the time, every day. He never leaves us and he never forsakes us. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Should we sing something?